A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel's been dealing with the pharmacy gauntlet again. His doctor wants to bump his Vyvanse dose up. Reasonable. Happens all the time. And the pharmacy tells him he needs to physically return his remaining lower dose capsules before they'll fill the new prescription. Count them out, hand them over, then we'll talk. Meanwhile, a friend of his with a medical cannabis card for chronic back pain gets his supply delivered to his door with a smile and a receipt. Daniel wants to know why the compassion trend that swept through drug policy in the last decade has somehow skipped over ADHD patients entirely. What makes these two drugs so different in the eyes of the law? And what can responsible stimulant users actually do to push for the same kind of normalization that medical cannabis patients now take for granted?
The short version is that cannabis advocates spent 30 years building a cultural and political movement that routed around federal law entirely. ADHD patients are still fighting inside the same regulatory cage that was built in 1970, and the cage has only gotten tighter.
So we're talking about two drugs that both carry recreational baggage. Both have accepted medical use, but one gets delivered with a courtesy call, and the other requires a ritual pill-counting ceremony. That's the asymmetry we're digging into.
And the thing is, the legal architecture that creates this asymmetry is weird once you look at it side by side. Cannabis is Schedule 1. That's the most restrictive category the DEA has. No accepted medical use, high abuse potential, completely illegal at the federal level. Stimulants like Vyvanse and Adderall are Schedule 2, accepted medical use, but high abuse potential and severe dependence liability. So cannabis is technically more illegal, and yet 38 states have medical programs where patients face none of the pharmacy-level friction that a Schedule 2 patient deals with every month.
The more illegal drug is easier to get. That's where we're starting.
That's where we're starting. And the reason traces back to how the Controlled Substances Act works. Schedule 2 is the tightest cage for drugs the government admits had medical value. The DEA sets aggregate production quotas every year. They decide exactly how much raw amphetamine can be manufactured, period. Every manufacturer gets an allocation, and they can't exceed it. In 2022 and 2023, the DEA kept those quotas essentially flat even as ADHD diagnoses surged during the pandemic. Telehealth expanded, more people got evaluated, prescription rates went up, and the DEA said no, the total amount of stimulant that can exist in the United States this year is the same as last year.
So the shortage wasn't a manufacturing problem, it was a quota problem.
Exactly what NPR reported in August of 2023. Manufacturers had the capacity to produce more, but the DEA hadn't authorized it. Pharmacies couldn't get supply, and when they did get it, they rationed it. That's where the we-can-only-fill 15-days notices came from. Patients driving to 15 different pharmacies, being told they're out of Adderall, or they have the brand name, but insurance won't cover it, or they have the generic, but only in the wrong dose.
And at the pharmacy counter, you're not just dealing with the quota shortage. You're dealing with the whole enforcement culture that Schedule 2 creates. Paper prescriptions, no refills, no transfers between pharmacies, exact day counts before you can fill the next one.
The paper prescription thing is one of those details that sounds trivial until you're living it. A lot of states still require a hard copy paper prescription for Schedule 2 drugs. Your doctor can't just send it electronically. Or if they can, the pharmacy might refuse to accept it anyway, because their corporate policy says paper only for CI2. So you're physically carrying a piece of paper from your doctor's office to the pharmacy every single month. Lose it, and you're out of luck. No replacement without a new doctor visit.
And then there's the pill-counting ritual Daniel described. Bring us your remaining capsules before we fill the new dose. Where does that actually come from?
This is where it gets interesting, because the answer isn't what most people assume. There's a federal regulation, 21 CFR 1306-101, that covers partial filling of Schedule 2 prescriptions. It says that if a pharmacy can't fill the full quantity, they can do a partial fill, but the remainder has to be completed within 72 hours. It also says that if the pharmacist can't complete the fill within that window, the unused portion has to be. The regulation says the pharmacy has to account for it. The language is about the pharmacy's record-keeping obligations, not about the patient returning pills for a dose change.
So the DEA didn't actually write a rule saying, make the patient bring back the old pills one by one before you can issue a new dose.
They did not. What happened is that the pharmacy chains, CVS, Walgreens, and the others, looked at the DEA's enforcement posture and decided the safest thing to do was overcomply. Their legal team said, if there's any ambiguity about where these pills went, we're the ones who get audited. So they built internal policies that go well beyond what the regulation actually requires. Demand the old medication back. Count the pills individually. Document everything. Treat every dose increase like a potential diversion investigation.
So the patient is standing at the counter thinking the DEA is making them do this, and it's actually a corporate risk management policy written by a lawyer who's never spoken to a person with ADHD.
And the pharmacist behind the counter probably hates it too. They didn't go to pharmacy school to count out 37 capsules while a patient stares at them. But the chain's policy manual says do it, and the pharmacist knows that a DEA audit can shut down their entire operation if the paperwork doesn't match, so they enforce rules that don't actually exist in federal law.
ADDtude magazine has documented cases of this. Patients being told to bring in their remaining pills, counted one by one at the counter, before the pharmacy would authorize a dose increase that the doctor had already approved. The doctor had called three times. Didn't matter.
There's a whole layer of private sector restrictions on top of the federal ones. CVS and Walgreens have policies against filling stimulant prescriptions from out-of-state prescribers, even when it's completely legal. They limit early refills to 2 days before the previous prescription runs out. So if you're going on vacation and need to fill 3 days early, too bad. Some of them require government ID every single time, even if you've been filling the same prescription at the same pharmacy for 5 years. None of this is in the Controlled Substances Act. It's corporate compliance departments running scared of the DEA.
Let's put the cannabis comparison next to this, because it's where Daniel's question really bites. Walk me through what a medical cannabis patient experiences.
Cannabis is Schedule 1 federally. That means the federal government's official position is that it has no accepted medical use and high abuse potential, a more severe classification than Vyvanse. But 38 states have said, we disagree and we're creating our own medical programs. Those programs operate entirely outside the federal prescription system. There's no DEA quota on how much cannabis can be grown for medical use in Oklahoma. There's no federal prescription database tracking every purchase. The pharmacy, well, it's not even a pharmacy, it's a dispensary, doesn't have to comply with 21 CFR 1306 because they're not dispensing under federal law at all.
So the patient walks in with a state-issued card, buys what they need, and walks out. No paper prescription, no pill counting, no come back in exactly 30 days.
In many states, they don't even need to walk in. Delivery is standard. You order online, someone brings it to your door, and the whole transaction is less friction than ordering a pizza. Meanwhile, the ADHD patient is driving to the pharmacy for the third time this week because the first two trips, they were told the medication was out of stock or the prescription had some technical problem that requires the doctor to call in again.
The Schedule I drug has a smoother patient experience than the Schedule II drug. That's the paradox Daniel is living in.
And the reason, I think, comes down to strategy. The cannabis movement made a deliberate choice decades ago to target state-level legalization and cultural normalization simultaneously. They didn't try to get cannabis rescheduled at the federal level first. They went state by state, built medical programs that demonstrated real patient benefit, and let the cultural shift follow. By the time anyone was seriously debating federal rescheduling, 38 states had already made the decision for them. The federal government was the last to know.
Whereas ADHD medication advocacy has been fighting inside the federal framework the whole time, trying to get the DEA to adjust quotas, trying to get Schedule 2 rules relaxed, trying to work within the system that was designed to be restrictive.
Right, and the cultural piece is even more important. Cannabis had a "it's just weed" normalization campaign that ran for decades. Movies, music, popular culture, and eventually organized advocacy groups like InnoNormel and the Marijuana Policy Project that framed medical use as reasonable, compassionate, and normal. They ran campaigns called things like Cannabis Conversations that were explicitly about getting people to talk openly about their medical cannabis, used the way they'd talk about any other medication.
Nobody's running Adderall conversations.
Nobody is. And the stigma runs in the opposite direction. Cannabis's recreational reputation actually helped normalize it. The cultural familiarity made medical use seem less threatening. Stimulants have the opposite problem. The recreational narrative around Adderall is study drug and college kids abusing it to cram for exams, and the methamphetamine association is always lurking in the background. So the cultural signal is, these are dangerous drugs that people fake symptoms to get, not, these are effective medications that help millions of people function.
The regulatory response to that stigma has been to tighten, not loosen. Every time there's a news story about Adderall abuse on college campuses, the DEA gets more pressure to restrict supply. The quotas get tighter, the enforcement gets more aggressive, and the pharmacy chains add another layer of internal policy to protect themselves.
And the patients who suffer from that aren't the college kids buying Adderall from a friend. They're the 40-year-old with a legitimate diagnosis and a decade of stable treatment who now has to justify their existence to a pharmacy technician every 30 days.
So, what does advocacy actually look like for those patients? Daniel asked what people can do, and I don't want to just describe the problem.
There's an organization called CHAD-D, Children and Adults with Attention, Deficit Hyperactivity Disorder, that's actually built some of the infrastructure for this. They have an Advocacy Action Center on their website where you can look up your state legislators, find relevant bills about ADHD medication access, and send pre-written emails. They do action alerts when there's federal legislation that affects stimulant prescribing. The tools exist.
But the focus has been on access to treatment broadly. Making sure people can get diagnosed, making sure insurance covers it, fighting stigma in schools and workplaces. It hasn't been specifically about deregulating the prescribing process, the way cannabis advocates targeted legalization.
That's the gap. CHAD will help you tell your congressman to support ADHD funding, but they're not running a campaign to say Schedule II restrictions on stimulants are disproportionate and need to be reformed. And I think part of the reason is that the abuse narrative is so powerful that advocacy groups are cautious about appearing to downplay it. If you say, make Adderall easier to get, the immediate response from regulators and the media is, you want to make amphetamines more available? The conversation stops there.
The cannabis movement's playbook might actually be instructive. They didn't lead with, make cannabis easier to get. They led with patients, people with cancer, chronic pain, PTSD, telling their stories publicly. They made the cultural case first, and the policy changes followed.
The ADHD community has those stories in abundance. Millions of people who take stimulants responsibly, whose lives are dramatically better because of them, who have stable careers and relationships and aren't diverting their medication or abusing it. But those stories are mostly told in private, because admitting you take Adderall or Vyvanse still carries a whiff of something shameful in a way that saying you use medical cannabis doesn't anymore.
The cannabis patient gets to say, this is my medicine, and most people nod. The ADHD patient says, this is my medicine, and gets asked if they really need it, or if they've tried lifestyle changes, or if they're sure they're not just looking for an edge at work.
The first advocacy step might be the simplest and hardest. Talk about it. Normalize it. The more people who say openly, I take Vyvanse, it's prescribed, it works, and I'm not apologizing for it, the harder it becomes to treat every stimulant prescription as potential drug seeking. That's what the cannabis movement did. They made it boring. They made it so common that the stigma couldn't hold.
There are concrete policy steps, too. Electronic prescribing mandates for Schedule II. A lot of states still require or allow paper prescriptions, and that creates friction and opportunities for pharmacies to refuse service. Pushing state pharmacy boards to investigate corporate overcompliance. If CVS is adding restrictions that go beyond federal law, patients can file complaints with the state board that licenses that pharmacy. And separating stimulant regulation from opioid regulation in the legislative conversation. Right now, a lot of the enforcement infrastructure was built for opioids and got applied to stimulants by default, even though the abuse patterns and risks are completely different.
The opioid comparison is important. The DEA's aggressive posture on Schedule II enforcement is driven largely by the opioid crisis. Pharmacies got sued for filling too many opioid prescriptions, so now they treat every controlled substance with the same level of suspicion. But the overdose risk profile of prescription stimulants is nothing like opioids. The diversion patterns are different. The patient population is different. Lumping them together in the same regulatory bucket creates barriers that don't match the actual risk.
The cannabis comparison shows that a different approach is possible. The federal government still classifies cannabis as more dangerous than Vyvanse, but the practical experience of patients is the opposite. That happened because advocates built an alternative system at the state level and made the cultural case so effectively that federal policy became almost irrelevant.
The question is whether ADHD advocates can do something similar, not necessarily state-by-state legalization, because stimulants are already legal with a prescription, but state-level reforms that reduce the pharmacy-level friction. Some states have already started. Electronic prescribing mandates for controlled substances are spreading. A few states have passed laws preventing pharmacies from refusing to fill legitimate prescriptions based on corporate policies that go beyond state law. Those are winnable fights.
Daniel's specific experience. Being asked to return pills for a dose increase, that's something a state pharmacy board complaint could actually address. If the regulation doesn't require it, and the pharmacy can't point to a specific law that mandates it, the board has the authority to tell them to stop.
CHADS Action Center has the tools to find your state pharmacy board contact information and send that complaint. It's not a march on Washington. It's an email to the right regulator saying this pharmacy is imposing requirements that don't exist in federal or state law, and it's interfering with my medical care.
The thing that strikes me about all of this is that the barriers we're describing don't actually prevent diversion. Someone who wants to sell their Adderall isn't going to be stopped by a paper prescription requirement or a 2-day early refill limit. They'll find a way. The barriers mostly catch people who are trying to follow the rules. People who need a dose adjustment, or who are traveling, or whose doctor is out of state.
That's the tragedy of overcompliance. It creates friction for legitimate patients while doing almost nothing to stop the behavior it's supposedly targeting. The DEA quotas don't stop Adderall from being available on college campuses. They stop pharmacies from filling prescriptions for diagnosed patients. The pill-counting ritual doesn't catch drug dealers. It humiliates people who are just trying to get their dose right.
I keep coming back to the image of Daniel's friend getting his cannabis delivered while Daniel is counting out capsules at a pharmacy counter. That's not just two different regulatory systems. That's two different assumptions about who the patient is. The cannabis patient is assumed to be legitimate until proven otherwise. The stimulant patient is assumed to be a potential abuser until they prove their innocence every 30 days.
Changing that assumption is the advocacy work. It's not just about changing laws, it's about changing the default posture from suspicion to trust. The cannabis movement did that by making patients visible. ADHD patients are still largely invisible, or visible only in the negative. The Adderall abuse on campus story, the Are We Over-Medicating Children debate. The positive stories of responsible long-term stimulant use are barely in the public conversation.
Daniel's question, what can patients do? Has an answer that's both simple and difficult. Use the existing advocacy infrastructure to push for specific policy changes at the state level. File complaints when pharmacies impose rules that don't exist in law. And talk openly about being a responsible stimulant user. Make it boring. Make it normal. The policy will follow the culture, not the other way around.
The next time a pharmacy asks you to bring in your old pills, ask them to show you the regulation that requires it.
They can't. I know because I asked. I worked at the CVS in New Jersey in 2019, pharmacy tech, 3 months, the shortest job I've ever had. A woman came in with a dose increase for Adderall XR. Her doctor had called 3 times. The pharmacist on duty told her to go home, get her remaining pills, and bring them back to be counted before we could fill the new script. 37 capsules. I said, show me the regulation. She said it's DEA policy. I said, show me the DEA policy. She couldn't. It was in the CVS operations manual, not in the code of federal regulations.
Oh, so you quit.
We agreed to disagree, and I quit. The point is, the pharmacy chains are the ones making this miserable. The DEA sets the quota and does the audits. The chains write the policies that turn every prescription into an interrogation. And they do it because their legal departments decided it's cheaper to hassle patients than to risk a DEA audit finding a discrepancy in the controlled substance log.
The villain in this story isn't really the DEA, it's corporate risk management.
The DEA creates the climate, the chains create the weather, and patients complain to the wrong people. They call their congressman about the DEA when they should be filing complaints with the state pharmacy board about CVS. The board licenses the pharmacy. The board can investigate whether their internal policies are interfering with patient care. Most patients don't know that.
The pharmacy board is a more useful target than Congress, for the specific barriers Daniel's describing.
Much more useful. Congress isn't going to rewrite the Controlled Substances Act because someone had a bad experience at Walgreens. But a state pharmacy board will absolutely investigate a complaint that a chain is imposing requirements that don't exist in state or federal law. They've done it before. In 2018, the California Board issued guidance telling pharmacies to stop refusing to fill legitimate controlled substance prescriptions based on internal policies that went beyond legal requirements. That came from patient complaints.
That's a concrete example of the thing actually working.
It works if people use it. Most people just switch pharmacies or find a different doctor or give up on the dose increase. They don't file the complaint. The cannabis people, they filed complaints, they sued. They ran ballot initiatives. They made themselves impossible to ignore. ADHD patients are easier to ignore because they're too exhausted by their own executive function challenges to mount a campaign against a pharmacy chain.
That's a grim point. The condition itself makes advocacy harder.
It does. But the tools are there. SHAD has the templates. The pharmacy board has the complaint form. The regulation doesn't say what the pharmacy says it says. Someone just has to be annoying enough to make them prove it.
Hilbert, you said 37 capsules. Do you remember what happened to the woman?
She came back the next day with the pills. I wasn't there. The pharmacist counted them out, filled the new script, and documented everything in the log. The system worked exactly as CVS designed it to work. The patient got her medication eventually. She just had to be humiliated first.
That's the part that doesn't show up in any regulation. The humiliation is a feature, not a bug. It's designed to make the process unpleasant enough that only people who really need the medication will put up with it. But the people who really need it are exactly the ones who shouldn't have to.
This has been my Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flemingtop.
The open question we're left with is whether the current ADHD medication shortage, which is still ongoing, and which is fundamentally a DEA quota problem, will force a reckoning with Schedule II regulation, or whether it'll just entrench the barriers further. The cannabis movement succeeded by building cultural acceptance first. ADHD advocates might need to do the same.
If you want to dig into the specifics of Schedule II regulations or the CHAD advocacy tools we mentioned, the show notes will have links. And if you've got your own pharmacy war story, email the show at show@myweirdprompts.com. We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My Weird Prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My Weird Prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.